having to almost like suppress certain emotions and thoughts because we're being professional. We're looking after someone else. And we're constantly in that caregiver role, and that takes its toll. And then beyond that, like, we want to be happy and we want to be thriving. We want to get, like you were saying, we want to get beyond baseline to optimal states. Yeah. How do we do that?
This is Dental Leaders, the podcast where you get to go one-on-one with emerging leaders in dentistry. Your hosts, Payman Langrudi and Prav Solanki.
A special episode of the podcast from the book launch of Mark Khwaja's book, which is called Resilience
and Wellbeing,
for dental professionals. I was surprised at the name of the book, Mara, because all the other names of your brands are so cool and in a zippy mind flossing, mind ninja, was it? Brain flossing.
Yeah, mind flossing toolkit. Absolutely. I appreciate that question. So I actually desperately wanted this to be a really fun, cool, catchy kind of a name, but I'm working with publishers. Wiley Blackwell, and they were not having any of it.
Really?
So for them, it was really important that it was a searchable title, and people were able to find it, and so it made sense for them to put those.
That's the
topics.
Reason.
So there was no way around it. They didn't even want me to have a subtitle, so I would have loved to have a little something in there.
So Mara, tell me, from the moment that you decided I am going to write a book to the moment that a week ago it came out, how long was that process?
It's been a really long process, actually. I think I started talking about this 2019.
Yeah.
And then I actually got round to pitching the concept to Wiley in 2020.
And how did you even know that's what you had to do? Like, pitching to Wiley? Like, did you research? Did you Google? How do you publish a book?
No, actually, I have. I have a dental coach. I've got quite a few coaches, actually.
Okay.
And Dr. Janine Brooks has written quite a few books for Wiley.
Okay.
And I was in a coaching session with her, and I was just talking about publishing a book and creating something. And actually, I thought you had to write the book and then you pitch it to the publisher. Actually, that's not the way at all. Yes. So you pitch a proposal. Dr. Brooks was really kind in kind of introducing me to Wiley in the first place, because actually what you would otherwise do is have an agent. You can't just approach a publisher. You have an agent, and then they help you with creating a proposal and putting that together. So I wrote a proposal and also attached this really fun little kind of teaser of the book. So I had actually been creating kind of worksheets whilst I'd been teaching, like the year before. So I'd done lots of kind of workshops and created loads of worksheets around that. So that was always going to be integral to the book. Like, it needed to be practical. So
It's full of worksheets and exercises and colors and just a lot going on in that book. 300 pages.
Yes.
So what was your process for researching and then writing that?
I mean, honestly, it was a complete joy to write. So the way I did my writing was I thought of a skeleton and what I wanted it to look like. And for me, it was important that it was a journey. So exploring and spotlighting the evidence-based tools and coming up with some sort of resilience framework. And then actually thinking about how to make those habits that stick. So that kind of that really spotlighted the whole journey. So firstly, like, learning about the tools and how do you make them sustainable. And so then it wasn't actually too bad at all. So it was a matter of sitting down, working on it chapter by chapter and getting on with the first draft. So putting pen to paper, as you will, and just writing, looking at the evidence base, incorporating that, thinking of creative ways to do that. But firstly, you've just got to get the words on paper, and then you can start like having fun in the editing process. So it was really honestly joyful and not as hard as what people make it out to be.
It seems like it feeds you. You seem so energized by this process. And it's so lovely to see that, because I remember the beginning of this process three, four, five years ago, when you initially started talking to me about just getting into this space. When you pitch this sort of stuff to not only publishers, but when you talk to dentists and you know, it's such a big area, mental health, right?
Yeah.
And just when we were sitting there, you were making the comparison to, you know, going to the gym. And a really nice thing that you're saying, you know, it's not only for when you're in trouble, it's for optimization.
Yeah.
Other tools you use for someone who's in trouble, similar to the tools you use for someone who wants to optimize mentally? I mean, it's a lovely thing. It's almost like, do I have a therapist because I need a therapist, or do I have a therapist because I want a therapist, kind of thing? What are your thoughts around that?
Yeah, I think it's a really, really important kind of question. I think it's really important to think of training your mind as you would like train your physical body.
Yeah.
And so these tools, you can use them in so many different ways. So whether you're unwell, so it would certainly be applying those same kind of tools, but in a slightly different way, because you don't want to overwhelm yourself when you're experiencing illness. So it would be a slightly different approach.
Yeah.
But certainly you can apply a lot of the things, no matter
where you are on that spectrum.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just delivering it in a way that's engaging. And also like truly experimenting with the tools and seeing what fits the person best. That's like really, really crucial.
And then the work that you've done, where you go into organizations and try and change the culture for sort of a positive culture. Explain that to me. If I know you're going to bigger and better organizations than dental practices only, right? But from the dental practice perspective, if you were going to come into a dental practice and try and improve the culture of that practice, let's say it's a bit of a, we've all worked in a practice where there's a bit of a toxic culture.
Yeah.
Not only, I know you had some examples where, you know, you had a boss associate nightmare, and that happens a lot. But we see it a lot in dental practice, just within teams, there's toxicity. How do you start to, first of all, even assess what is the culture of this place that I've walked into? And then secondly, change that culture in what? How? I mean, it must take more than one visit to change culture in a place.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got a whole chapter on this very topic.
Really?
Where I delve into creating positive work cultures. I think it's absolutely massive and crucial when it comes to our sense of well-being and also the team's productivity and profitability. Yeah. It's all linked. And so there are many kind of routes to this. But I mean, firstly, it is talking to your team and finding out more about their needs as well, and creating a culture of psychological safety. So when we use this term, we're talking about an environment where your colleagues feel safe to share concerns without reprimand. You can actually, just be your authentic
general
self.
General concerns.
Yeah, general concerns.
Mental health concerns.
Not just mental, I'm talking about general, like things you're unhappy about in terms
of
what's going
on.
Be able to talk openly. And to create that culture that's open door policy.
Yeah.
Not every practice is okay with that.
Certainly not, yeah.
But embedding psychological safety is really underpins well-being. And as I was saying, it all leads to positive outcomes anyway.
Yeah.
So creating that culture which is open, you're saying that you're comfortable for feedback. I want to know it, and I want to know your thoughts. And to not be defensive at that point, it does take a lot of work, I think, for management side of things.
Yeah. But
really, really important. And then another aspect that's absolutely crucial is thinking about mental health first aid and having this available for the whole team. So go on a course on mental health first aid. It's very accessible. 2 days, brilliant time.
What do you mean? What does it mean?
So you learn the tools and you learn the early signs and symptoms of mental illness.
In yourself and in others.
Exactly. So now you can, as a team, start recognizing when your team member needs support. And then you can have the conversations with them around mental health, ill health I'm talking about. So we're talking about things like depression, anxiety, suicidal thoughts. And you can signpost them appropriately, because there are things at crisis point for us. So if you have...
So throw out a couple of those. What are they? irritability, sleeplessness? What is it?
Yeah, so it's when someone is appearing to act differently to how they were before. Yeah, so it's about maybe eating more or eating less, not sleeping well. You might notice them physically look different. They might be more aggressive. They might be withdrawn.
Yeah.
But just starting to recognize those signs is really, really important. And then you'll actually be taught how to talk about mental illness in a way that's kind, loving, non-judgmental, compassionate. And you're going to start creating that culture that's more accepting and open. So that's one aspect. Another massive aspect, I believe, obviously, is resilience and well-being education, and have psychological tools accessible for everyone. So it's not just about reducing burnout in your team, but it's equally as important to get your team members to feel more engaged at work and living a life of meaning and purpose. And there are roots to this. So with the way when I'm teaching my programs and workshops, I'm talking about finding your strengths and bringing them to work. And there's different ways we can do this as well. So in positive psychology, there's a lot of research to support if you're using your strengths in challenges, as well as outside of challenges, you're going to feel better, you're going to be happy, and you're going to be more profitable.
There's an acronym, isn't there, for the 5-6 things you bring to that?
I don't know the acronym, though.
You said it yourself. Maybe it's a different thing. I don't know.
I heard you speaking
on some other podcast.
Yeah.
On Shardy's.
Okay. I don't remember an acronym, but strengths is really, really massive. Then you've got values. So bringing those into work and understanding your values. Gratitude, so creating a culture of gratitude. There's so many cool ways you can do this. So in your team meetings, playing gratitude ping pong. So sharing compliments back and forth, or like wins in your day, like small moments, big moments. Actually sharing it with your team amplifies positive emotions, and that is amazing. We've all understand that experientially. We've talked to others, shared our wins, and we've noticed an increase in our feelings of, you know, feeling more inspired, more grateful, more feelings of compassion, fulfillment, and meaning. Yeah. All of these beautiful emotions. So what positive emotions do in a team is they help broaden their perspective and to increase psychological resources. So that's really, really important. So that's a great way. So creating a culture of gratitude. It could be as simple as spotlighting someone who's really well in your team. You could have a gratitude board at work. You could have a gratitude WhatsApp. But actually honing into what's going well in your team is really, really worth celebrating, because you're going to create a culture where people feel recognized and supported, and it's joyful. So yeah, finding ways that you can integrate that could be a great way of changing culture. But yes, it does take time. This isn't something that happens overnight. It takes conversations, really getting to know your team and their unique needs. But there is well-being education out there that's evidence-based. There are frameworks that are useful.
Do you not get resistance when you go into a place from individuals?
Yeah, so not everyone's
going to... The stigma's still there, right? And some people feel like, well, I don't need this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can't bring everyone onto the table. You can only just share, look, we've got a course on, if you'd like to be part of it. Yeah. This is, it might be that it's compulsory, but I'd like you to engage in it. Like, it's fine if you can't engage in the way that I want you, that's absolutely fine. You've got to just make those choices available and not force things on people. But I think normally when people start to understand what this can do for them, then normally they're quite receptive, actually, because you know, people want to speak openly and be free and talk about things that truly matter to them. And this is where well-being truly shines, because you can share what's really going on, right? And often as dental professionals, we're having to almost like suppress certain emotions and thoughts because we're being professional. We're looking after someone else. And we're constantly in that caregiver role, and that takes its toll. And beyond that, like, we want to be happy and we want to be thriving. We want to get, like you were saying, we want to get beyond baseline to optimal states.
Yeah.
How do we do that? So even if like the illness side of things doesn't resonate, like, because you're like, okay, well, I've never experienced depression, like that just doesn't, I wouldn't, that doesn't impact me, right? That's okay if you feel like that. You can certainly benefit from just understanding mental health better, and you can help, you know, maybe your family or your kids, or you can also just learn to be more resilient or happier or more optimistic. So there's always something you can learn, because actually the brain is wired for negativity bias. It's full of automatic negative thoughts that are unhelpful. And so actually just even learning about thought patterns better and mindset is going to be really beneficial to you in terms of thriving. So I think anyone can get a benefit from this. It's fine if that person's resistant. We don't want to push anything on anyone, but it's just about hopefully them being curious and having an open mind, and who knows, they might discover something really useful and beneficial.
Sure. One final question.
Yes.
And it's a serious one. Suicide in dentistry. Now, you've looked at so much research. Is there research that says, number one, it's real, that dentists do commit suicide more than other professionals? Or is that sort of urban myth sort of thing? And number two, what's your opinion on why dentists? Like, you know, why not brain surgeons? Why not some other type of professional?
Yeah, so the rates of suicide are higher in dental professionals than other sectors. Of course, like, healthcare professionals are all in a similar pool. So if you even look pre-pandemic, so there's going to be a bunch of research, obviously, post-pandemic, but pre-pandemic, Toon and colleagues in 2019 did a study on UK general dental practitioners and found that 10% experienced suicidal thoughts.
Yeah,
so yes, they didn't commit suicide, but 10%.
Yeah,
so the general public is 5%. So this is higher in our population. And so what the research spotlights into why, like, why is this happening? Why particularly us? Lots of different reasons. It's multifactorial. Some of the factors are because of organizational issues. So things like contract, UDA targets, admin issues, staffing, all of those aspects. Work culture, obviously, all feeds into it. Then you've got the risk of litigation.
What I read 50 years ago in Kansas,
yeah,
dentists had a higher chance of suicide than other professionals.
Mm.
You know what I mean? There was no UDA, there was no contract, there wasn't.
So it doesn't.
What is it about the job itself?
Yeah, so it doesn't. So it may not be UDAs, but it's the organisational kind of framework that. So, like I said, staffing issues, that's not practices.
Yeah.
So that's like almost like, many practices can relate to that. But kind of beyond that, let's just take the patient factors.
Yeah.
Simply us working with patients who are in distress.
Awake.
Yeah, awake, but anxious. They might be going through trauma. You know, we see them regularly, like 3 months sometimes, and we're actually with them in their journey. They're going through divorce, they might be raped. There's so much stuff that we deal with. And a patient comes in and we're looking after them, we're the caregiver. So simply being around that much trauma can feed into ourselves, and we can simply take on a patient's pain. That's called compassion fatigue when you take it to its extreme.
Yeah, but then why not, you know, psychologists or GPs? I mean, there's something about dentistry.
Yeah, I mean,
the loneliness of the room.
Yeah, so then you've got other factors, such as individual factors. So in our niche, we've got high levels of perfectionism, and that can lead to things like burnout and psychological distress. We've got imposter syndrome. It's quite high in our profession as well. We might not have the self-care tools there's loneliness as well, and loneliness actually increases our levels of stress. And as we know, chronic stress states are really harmful for mentally and physically. So there's all of those aspects.
And it's such an unfair question to ask you, isn't it, at this moment, to say why? But I have to know what you thought about it.
It's so multifactorial. There isn't one aspect. And then the other aspect I haven't spotlighted was just the risk of litigation and the stress of regulation. So our bodies are regulating us. It's not that they're regulating us. It's more like when there is a fitness to practice case, it takes so long for that case to go through, and there's so much anguish in that period. So there's that aspect, and that's not just UK based, that's, you know, that's everywhere globally. So there's that as a factor as well. And so there's a range there, really. And then obviously you've got things that aren't in the research yet, the social media, and we're making constant upwards social comparisons, and dentistry is so visual. So, you know, you've got that aspect as well.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, we're not taught the tools, the psychological tools early on. Like, I think it's madness.
It should be in the undergrad. Like, what you said, it needs to be in there, but a whole lot of stuff needs to be in the undergrad, right? And a whole lot of stuff shouldn't be in the undergrad.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, we spend hours and hours and hours doing things that most dentists never do.
Yes.
And then things like this, things like how do you get a loan for a business, you know, simple stuff like that,
life skills.
Not covered at all.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We could definitely shift that. But then even beyond that, postgraduate, we need more of an emphasis on this.
Sure.
And not just anecdotal advice, but more evidence-based. Sure. I think it would be great to move towards that. So I think that's the way of the future.
Anyway, it's such a pleasure to see you doing this, to bring out the book. One more time, say the title and where they can get it.
Oh, thank you so much, Faye. It's been a pleasure. It's Resilience and Wellbeing for Dental Professionals, and you can get it in Amazon. It's also available in Waterstones and Spears and all sorts of places. But yeah, it's absolutely everywhere. And it's global, so which is wicked, but Amazon, probably the cheapest place you can get it.
Amazing.
It's on a really good deal right now.
And such a lot of resource in that book, so check that book out. I certainly will be getting a few copies right now. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much. Hey.
This is Dental Leaders, the podcast where you get to go one-on-one with emerging leaders in dentistry. Your hosts, Payman Langrudi and Prav Solanki.
Thanks for listening, guys. Hope you enjoyed today's episode. Make sure you tune in for future episodes. Hit subscribe in iTunes or Google Play or whatever platform it is. And, you know, we really, really appreciate it if you would...
give us a 6-star rating.
6-star rating. That's what I always leave my Uber driver.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Bye.